We'll go now to the question and answer period at a climate presentation by Dr. David Chapman of the University of Utah. Dr. Chapman is a professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. He's an honored member of the American Geophysical Society. This recording was made by Radio EcoShock at the Canadian Memorial United Church in Vancouver, Canada, on February 5th, 2008. The evening was organized by VTRAC, the Vancouver Temperate Rainforest Action Coalition.
Two firsts for me. I've never had an opening act, and I've never spoken from a pulpit before, so it's terrific. So I'd be happy to take your questions. I hope you got a handout. I prepared a one-page handout that I think were handed out when you came in, but they have my URL where you can find all these slides. So you can go and if you want to download them, if you're educators or just want to look at them again, then you can download them. I also put two very useful websites. One is the New Scientist website, which answers many questions about global warming, and the other is the Pew Center on Climate Change, which I think is really useful. I could have put the Suzuki webpage, I could have put VTAC, etc., but you're aware of those and can follow them. Yes?
My question is actually a political one, and I think it's probably kind of fitting as we're all sitting here missing the results from Super Tuesday. I know in Canada, I'm the Green.
What happened?
I have no idea. I'm waiting to find my results too. This is how much I love climate change that it's really itching to go home. I'm a member of the Green Party here, and I know on our political front, we've been supportive of the carbon tax, but we've really had a hard time getting that messaging through to other parties in this country. I'm just wondering, on the American side of the border, I don't know how my fellow Greens are doing that, how's the political acceptance down there for the idea of a carbon tax? Are they ahead of us? Is there more support on the ground? Or is it just the Green Party in the States who are the only ones talking it as well?
I think the U.S. is far behind Canada. And in fact, I don't understand why there's all this enthusiasm for cap and trade. I was actually at a meeting in Massachusetts a couple of months ago. It was economists and political people and scientists, and we were supposed to talk to each other, but there was too little time for talk, and we all made our presentations and didn't resolve things. But it seems like all of the talk is about cap and trade. I'm not an economist, lowly geophysicist, but my reading of the situation is that cap and trade has so many loopholes and so many ways to exploit, and it just seems to me the simplest thing to do, if you want to curb emissions, you provide a neutral, revenue-neutral tax on them. It just seems to me the proper thing to do. I would not follow the United States on this. My advice to you.
Oh, no, we're not.
Hi, I'm Alex Smith from CFRO Radio. I do an environment program there. Two questions. First, I wondered if you were aware that the Canadian government has now asked for Canadian government scientists to put anything they want to say about the climate through the government's PR machine.
Terrible idea.
And the ministers before they speak out about what they know and what their studies reveal.
Yeah, that's a terrible idea. It's also happened in the United States. Jim Hansen, who works for NASA and is one of the most outspoken people and actually produced that first map that I showed you tonight, is under the same muzzle. So he has to have his stuff. I think when any agency says to scientists or anybody else in the community, you have to basically go through this filter, it's unfortunate. I mean, I don't understand why we have that, but if Canada is doing that, shame on them. Shame on us.
I agree. Well, my second question is, today I interviewed Robert Kunzig, who wrote in National Geographic about the drying of the West. And I wonder if you've seen signs, either personally or in your studies, of the drying out effects in Utah, the drawing down of the water tables, the developing drought in the southwest of the United States.
The drying down of the water table isn't directly associated with climate change. It's associated with overpopulation and building communities that wouldn't support them. Wallace Stegner, who is one of my very favorite authors, wrote Beyond the 100th Meridian, and when you fly across the country, at least south of the border, you come across, and all of a sudden you see these big circles on the ground is where you have to water artificially. And so we have huge populations in areas where there's not enough water to support that population in the ways that we've been using them. But people are inventing other ways. In LA, for example, Los Angeles, they just started a new system that's going to basically, they call it from the toilet to the tap. Right? It's not a very appetizing view, but it's basically reusing water that way. The issue of water and climate change is very interesting, but very involved. So we can predict temperature change with some confidence, but how you translate that into where the water goes and in what abundances is a much more difficult situation. Ironically, some of the predictions say in a warmer world, we're going to have more droughts and more floods. You could say, how could we have both more droughts and floods at the same time? It's the opposite end of the scale. But it probably means that with more water in the atmosphere, there's more water cycling, and it comes down out of the atmosphere in bigger amounts. So that's the flood part of it. And then because we can't keep the water in one place, then there may be more droughts in other parts of the world. But I think that we read more about them probably because of population than we do because of the slow climate change. Although I have to say, the ski areas in Utah are very scared. Park City, Utah is a very, very green city, and they're doing it in part to preserve their skiing in the future. I don't know if that answer, that's kind of a rambling answer to a rambling question. Thank you.
I have two burning questions, and I think the commonality between them both is, I guess, morals. The first one is, at the beginning of your presentation, you referred to this, opinion letter that went into the province this morning, where apparently there was an erroneous statement made. And I'm wondering, is there not an moral imperative for the media to vet letters to the editor that get printed if, and I guess that this is a really muddy water because that you get into freedom of speech, but if someone is saying something that is factually incorrect, but it gets printed and then it gets out there and people will read it and believe it, is there not some moral imperative on the media's part to, if not censor that, perhaps put an editor's note at the end of their letter to comment on it?
Are there any journalists or ethicists who'd like to talk about that? My view is that that's as dangerous as putting a muzzle on the scientists. I think that it's called the opinion page. It should be taken for people's opinions. And they can say what they say. It's our job as educators and as citizens to inform ourselves about an issue so that we can make the decisions. And I think that's what we have to do as educators. And so let people say what they want, and we have to have the capacity. We have to teach all of our citizens to have that capacity to say, what do we believe? And what do we not believe? I mean, it's especially true in the, in our internet age, where somebody said you have all the information at your fingertips, but we don't have knowledge. Some people say it's easy to inform people, it's hard to knowledge them. Right? So I think the issue on opinion pieces, I'd be in favor of editing it. So the far better thing is to educate people. I've given this talk roughly twice a month now to church groups, to citizen groups, to sports groups, to classrooms, etc. And I would hope that of those probably many thousand people that have seen this kind of story and maybe read my papers and so forth, they would have an ability to read that and say, he makes the claim that the temperatures haven't changed in 100 years, and they say, well, I've seen Chapman's presentation, that's just wrong. Okay, second part.
Second question is more of a personal moral dilemma about flying. And I know there's a lot of pros and cons out there in terms of carbon offsetting. And there's a lot of, I think, debate on both sides whether it's of any use or not. And I wonder what your opinion is on the whole carbon offsetting scheme with regards to flying. Does it work? Are there ones that are better than others?
That's a hard one. You know, I flew up here.
I'm glad you did.
Well, I flew to Seattle and drove from Seattle to here. Air traffic is one of the two really bad things, but it's the way we get around. If you read George Monbiot's book, it's concrete and airlines are the two things. How many people have done the ecological footprint? People know about that? So many people have done it. So the Chapmans have done it, and you've seen how we live. And we require four planets for our lifestyle. And the big thing is we fly. We fly for business, we fly for vacations and so forth. And you can't get it down. Even the greenest kids in my class, in my environmental classes, these are kids that come to school in Birkenstocks in the middle of winter and, you know, walk to work and so forth. It's a hard, if people don't know it, so you basically input all your lifestyle information and your choices. How do you live? How big is your house, your apartment? How do you get around? Are you a carnivore? Are you vegetarian? So you put all your information in and they say, you require so many hectares, agricultural and various things, to support you. And then they do a very cute thing. They say, if everybody in the world lived the way you did, here's how many planets we would need. I've never met a North American who has got down below about two planets. Right? And some of my colleagues go up to 7, 8, 10 planets. You live in a, you know, huge houses and drive multiple cars and fly a lot and so forth. So flying is what pushes the Chapmans up on that scale. I think my wife is arguing, Christine, your mother would say we can't fly in 2 years from now, we can't fly anymore. So airlines are a problem.
Yes.
What? What about carbon offset? I haven't thought about that deeply enough to know whether that's real or greenwashing. Would anyone like to speak about carbon offset? Who knows more? The person behind, do you want to let him speak about that?
I mean, I can't really say I know more about it, except I've thought about it and argued about it, and I have to agree with Monbiot that carbon offsets are the equivalent of indulgences in the Middle Ages. It permits us to go on committing sin.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Back to the question.
Yeah. Adrian Carr, Deputy Leader, Green Party of Canada and candidate in Vancouver Centre. I first of all, thank you for coming here, and not only that, for just being so incredibly revelatory about your science. I really
thank
appreciate
you.
It because I honestly believe that without the scientists who have spoken out and without the consensus of the IPCC scientists, we would not be having the discussions tonight. We would not be moving forward in whatever ways we are. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And it makes me, though, think about this question. I was waiting through your whole talk to have you speak to the issue of the tipping point and all the IPCC reports which have been saying at all costs we have to take action to avoid an average, an increase of 2 degrees centigrade average global warming. And you didn't talk about it. And part of me is going, oh my God, it means it's too late. He's not saying it because it's too late and we're beyond it. And I want you to tell me, are we too late? I want you to tell me the truth. But I want to know what your opinion is on that.
I'm happy to do that. I didn't speak about the tipping point because I do not know from my own work and from my careful reading whether where we are with respect to an irreversible change. And I hope I've impressed you, if not with anything else, that I try to be a genuine scientist. I approach my work carefully. I don't speak as a fanatic. I'm not on the barricades, but I'm clearly green. With respect to the tipping point, what I hear from colleagues is that a change of temperature of about 2 degrees C will seriously change things. But here are some of the cautions. I have a very good friend, Richard Alley, who is at Penn State University, and he has this lovely phrase, which I think is really good. He said, climate has dials and switches. Think about that. What does he mean? It has dials and switches. It means you can change it. You know, you can move your AM dial, etc. But all of a sudden, you know, they're broadcasting FM and you're in a different world. So we don't really know, I think, whether it's 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees. But here's a sobering thought. Marcia McNutt, who is the head of Mbari. What's Mbari? The Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Was in Utah last week and talked about the disappearance of skate as a commercial fish in Monterey Bay, and it's because it is it's been invaded by giant squids, and the squid is a predator on the hake rather, and the hake the commercial fishery is finished, and that's a temperature change. And someone in the audience said, "How much of a temperature change was that? It was 0.2 degrees." Of the water temperature caused that. Is that a tipping point? Certainly. So I think there are many little tipping points. For the village of Sheshmerev, would you call it a tipping point that the village is washed out to sea? I mean, in a sense it is. So I think there are already demonstrable things and serious things going on, but can we say as scientists that if we go beyond a certain point, it's going to be irreversible and lots of nasty things will happen? I'm not quite willing to go there because I think that's kind of a catastrophist. Mm. And I'm more optimistic than that. Now, should that allow us to just be modifiers? Should we just adjust to climate change and say it's here and do nothing? Absolutely not. Is that too wishy-washy for
no,
you?
No, that was clear. Thank you for being an optimist, too.
Yes, sir.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for this evening. I came in here with about a 0.05 degree of hope for the planet, and I think you've got it up to a 0.1, perhaps. So that's
hey, that's a doubling that's, in about an hour.
That's quite an achievement. I have a suggestion and a question. Or the question's more political, so I have to bend over to this microphone. But it always seems when people talk, and they talk about, you know, what's going to happen at 2100 or in a century, and it's alarming and worrying and, oh, my goodness. But I wish people would more often talk about what will happen in 3 centuries, mm-hmm. 4 centuries, mm-hmm. Because from what I read, if we don't turn it around, humans will not be able to live on the planet, never mind cope. I don't know if that's a question, that's a comment. I'll say the other thing I wanted to say, and then I'll leave it to you. Or do you want to speak to that first?
I want to speak to that one. I'm not sure that humankind is threatened in the way that some catastrophists would say it is. We can live in temperature ranges that are very different. I mean, we have a 50 degrees C temperature change on average temperature between the equator and the poles, and we live in large parts of that temperature range. So we can do that, but the changes that are taking place that are more worrisome are the fact that agriculture cannot keep up. or biology cannot keep up, or the oceans cannot keep up. And what that could do is put huge pressures on us because we're a world of 7 billion people. But I don't see any reason that humans are going to disappear. I mean, one of the problems in the oceans is, that I didn't talk about at all tonight, is not the worrisome part is not the temperature in the oceans. Sea level rise is worrisome for people who live in low countries, but the big problem for the ocean is acidification. So when you take carbon dioxide and dissolve more of it in the oceans, it's a weak acid, and the pH of the oceans, pH being a measure of the acidity of the oceans, has decreased by a tenth of a pH unit already, on average. And probably, over the next 100 years that you don't like so much, will decrease about 6/10 of a pH unit. And it's not absolutely clear that all the organisms that are quite happy living in the ocean chemistry now will be happy in the future. If that takes down ocean productivity, then, you know, lots of things cascade. So, but it's a wonderful world. It's a delightful world, but it's a complicated world. And the political point.
I'm just concerned about the carbon tax as some kind of solution. At first I got kind of interested in it, and then when I heard what Carol Taylor was suggesting, with, you know, 3 or 4 cents a liter or some small amount rising by 2020, I worry about A, its effectiveness, and B, its fairness. Mm-hmm. It's all very well for Al Gore to say he's in favor of a carbon tax. He can afford it. Mm-hmm. But what about the people who've had to live in Mission because they can't afford to live in Vancouver, mm-hmm. and now they won't be able to afford to commute from Mission to Vancouver? A better solution, but a far less practical solution, but we've done it before,
yeah.
is rationing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to have my ration card that mm-hmm. tells me how much carbon I can use a year. And if I choose to use it to water ski once, that's my choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I choose to fly, that's my choice, mm-hmm. or whatever. But mm-hmm. at least that would be economically yeah. equal or fair.
Yeah, interesting idea. Can I ask my son-in-law to speak?
I would use my ration for heli-skiing if I had to use it up. But for one thing, I don't think that a carbon tax precludes rationing in the future if we need to do that. But I also think it's important that we clarify what we have been asking for and what most economists and big business organizations have been asking for, and we differentiate that from what Carol Taylor has been heard to say in the media. I agree a 3.5 cent tax on gasoline wouldn't really make much of a difference, and besides making a lot of people angry. So I think what most people are arguing for is a tax on all fossil fuels when they enter the economy at a fairly moderate level now, but increasing at a regular schedule over the next 10, 20, 30 years, so that people start getting a price signal now that they need to make long-term decisions now about how they're going to not just fuel their car when they go to the pump, but buy their next car, what kind of car they're going to buy next time, where they're going to live. If you're a business, what kind of boiler you're going to install. So this isn't just a one-off 3 cents a tax, 3 cents a liter tax on gas. It's a long-term schedule of putting increasing taxes on fossil fuels. And the second thing is that what we're arguing for, and what most groups are arguing for as well, other groups as well, is a revenue neutral carbon tax. So the idea is that it's a shift in taxes from income and earnings to emissions. And so that essentially the revenue for government stays the same because you're not just increasing taxes, you're lowering taxes on income. And you're right to say that there would be issues for people who are constrained in terms of where they live and that sort of thing, but we can address that through tax shifting as well as through for the least advantaged members of society through straight rebates. So the GST system could be used to provide a rebate on carbon tax if you make an income of less than $15,000 or $20,000 a year. You know, in the short term, the tax system is in place. It works. And it's efficient, and carbon taxes are a very straightforward way of putting a price on things. So over the long term, if we don't solve our problems, maybe rationing is the way to go. As far as doing this quickly, we could do a carbon tax this year.
My own feeling in kind of supporting this is that living in a country where to even breathe the word increase taxes on anything is anathema, I think that's got us into serious problems where we are now, that we are in very difficult economic situations, we're in a silly war, we're in a variety of other things, and nobody in the United States has been asked to sacrifice anything over the past decade or multiple decades, and it's just preposterous. And so if someone came out, if President Clinton or President Obama or President McCain came out to say, we are now in this serious situation. I have read IPCC. I've gone to a Chapman lecture, et cetera, and I believe we have to do something, and it'll cause us to have a tax. It would get people's attention. Taxes do get people's attention. So whether rationing is a good idea, it may come to that. Now, why don't we play it out 200 and 300 years in the future? Be quite happy to do that. And maybe we should. Although that gets us into a very interesting time when we're no longer a carbon-based economy because we've used up all our petroleum. And the fact that the U.S. went over its peak in the 1960s, so we produce about a half of the petroleum we need now and get it from elsewhere. So, and the world went over the top probably in this decade and is going to go down. So if we hold our breaths, in 300 years we're probably going to be okay. How's that for optimism? Yes, sir.
I want to thank you. My name's Fred Bass, and I actually have an MD and a doctor of science, and I feel it's very, very important to speak out. I think the world is at risk, and I'm very pleased that you are speaking out. I have a couple questions. One is, are you happy with the level of speaking out from your colleagues who are climate scientists?
Happy with the level of speaking out?
Yeah, speaking to the public.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very proud of my colleagues. I don't know of any colleague who feels muzzled by a funding agency or a superior, etc. I have never had anyone say to me, Chapman, you're wasting your time going up and speaking in a church in Canada, etc. I think, now not everybody enjoys it. Uh-huh. I love meeting people, I love talking about it, I love hearing your opinions, etc. So not all my colleagues are equally kind of fond of doing this.
Okay.
But I think the ones that do are really good. Jim Hansen and so forth. There's a whole bunch. John Overpeck in Arizona. I don't know the scientists at UBC. If Gary were still here, he would tell me. But I mean, when I finish a talk like this, I say, you know, have talk, we'll travel, or we'll, you know, bicycle or whatever. And so I wouldn't put that as a criticism.
I'm old enough to remember the beginning of the Second World War and the mobilization that took place. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me now that what we're facing is at least as serious a risk as the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, it seems to me that the rationing and the recycling that we did then certainly made the presence of the threat much more visible. And unfortunately, there's no enemy to point to other than our lifestyle now. And I wonder if you'd comment on the level of mobilization of this society.
I agree with your statement and your kind of, you know, preposition that there have been crises in the past that we've met, and this is not one that we have met in the same way. I mean, the crisis is affluenza, right? But the cure for that is something. I mean, people are quite happy with affluenza. I think it needs leadership. I think it's wrong to wait for leadership to come from the top. although I've mentioned a couple of times about President Obama, there is a sense among all generations south of the border that this could something different is happening. And I don't know whether Hillary Clinton is succeeding tonight and how that's going to work out, but if Barack Obama is elected, at least his rhetoric now speaks about leadership from a moral point of view, from a world, from a global point of view. We will not be isolationists. We will not be nation builders, but we will be good citizens in the future. So I think the combination, I mean, if you look at, you know, South Africa, right? Who would have thought that the changes that take place, and why did they happen? Because of the right person, Nelson Mandela, the right time, the conditions. So what we need is a variety of things, from citizens groups to larger groups, a general sort of coming together with the mindset, and then somebody at the top to build on that. How it's done, I don't know. But I value your statement and the analysis of the Second World War and the sacrifices that people made is totally appropriate. Any? How do you see it happening?
Well, a group of us have formed Community Climate Change, and we give global warming cafes, and I just want to put in a plug for one on the 23rd. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity for people to talk with each other. More than to hear from one speaker, an opportunity to build from the ground up, much like voters taking action for climate change. Excellent. Works. Yeah. So I have some flyers for the Saturday, the 23rd. And I think I'm an epidemiologist, and my feeling is we need to create a positive epidemic, and I hope this is the virus for it.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name's Tahiti Petey, with a Y at the end, .org. I've devoted the rest of my life now to increasing awareness of global climate change issues, including the pollution in the oceans and other effects. And what motivated me a couple years ago to start getting into this climate change environment is the amount of misinformation that I started reading. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could research to death, and I'd get five opinions on the same topic. One thing that started disturbing me was the IPCC reports, which I've read several times, and the scientists that came out and said, well, that wasn't really what I said, or I didn't really support that. And all these, quote, scientists that back up the reports are saying, well, you know, I don't know why they're using my name because I don't support that, or they watered down the true impact. And so what I see is a lot of information out there that is really watered down, and they're not really telling us the real truth. I mean, you've given a great presentation here, but I believe that we're all in for a really big, big awakening very soon about the planet's climate. It's happened. It's been happening for a few years. Sure, we have polluted the oceans and the planet tremendously, but I think we may be at that tipping point. And yet the global fear of that type of event, oceans rising, is why these political bodies around the world and the IPCC are watering down these reports. So from a scientific standpoint, my question is, even though scientists haven't been muzzled or required not to say this or that, are the reports being watered down? Are we just getting pieces of the information? Are we getting the truth? Because I don't believe we are.
Okay. In reverse order, you're getting the truth. You're not getting all of the information. But I had an insight in December in San Francisco to tell you exactly why. So we had a wonderful evening at the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union. And it was in celebration of receiving part of the Nobel Peace Prize. There were probably, so the American Geophysical Union is made of climate scientists, oceanographers, space scientists, and so forth. And there were probably 200 people there who got 1/2000th of the Nobel Peace Prize for that. And the insight was in people telling us what the process was. And you have to realize that it is a consensus report. And in any consensus report, there's clearly going to be people who said, you know, I didn't agree with that 100%. So is it watered down? Is a consensus report watered down? Yes, if you're one of the people that are on, you know, a standard deviation out from the norm. So in that sense it is, but in that sense it's a conservative report as well. I don't mind that. I think there's a lot of sense that comes in building a consensus report. But these people reported staying up all night and just staying at their desk and hammering out, you know, the final word. Are we confident? Are we absolutely sure of certain things? It is the best report that we have to guide us right now.
So is that the planet's hope, the IPCC reports, to update us and give us the truth? Is that what we, as citizens of the world, because, you know, I believe all change happens at the ground level and goes up.
Yeah, I mean, the terms you're using is that the truth? Is that giving us the truth, et cetera? It's a complex problem. You have well-meaning people working on it. I don't think anyone is muzzled. Individual national reports might be, but I think it's the best report that I have to go to. And then what you do for the outliers is read the individual papers and see what people are saying.
Okay.
Well, that was Dr. David Chapman answering questions from the audience. He's a professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. He's also an honored member of the American Geophysical Society. The speech was in Vancouver, Canada, on February 5, 2008. The recording of the speech and this question and answer period was made by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock for Nonprofit College and Community Radio. Find this speech and the question and answer period that followed on the Climate 2008 page of our website at ecoshock.org.